Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Tuesday, June 28th, 2022. This is the 17th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I am joined by Dr. Kevin Barrett, a regular columnist for the newspaper. All right, Dr. Kevin Barrett, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm well, John. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me once again. You are a regular columnist for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. And of course, I would encourage all of our listeners to subscribe to the newspaper. Check out AmericanFreePress.net. And I know you are also very busy. You host a number of radio programs, participate in a number of radio programs, and you also write on your Substack page. I pretty much follow you either on Twitter or on your Substack page. I mean, aside from what you're contributing to the newspaper as well, but you have a lot of different outlets, I know. So, but I found that those tend to be the most the easiest ways for me anyways to stay up to speed with your writings and your radio programs and stuff like that. So is there anything else you wanted to mention before we kind of jump into this?
Well, actually, that probably would do it. If people follow me either on Twitter or I can't believe I'm somehow still on Facebook, I just post everything I do, or I try to anyway, at those two places. And so if you subscribe to my Substack, preferably a paid subscription, that's kevinbarrett.substack.com. Or an unpaid one. Either way, I mean, you'll sort of keep abreast of what I'm up to.
Yeah, very good. And I know, like I said, I know you're very busy. You're doing a radio show, it seems like, almost every day. So definitely staying busy, covering some very important and very controversial topics, including your most recent article that you wrote for American Free Press, which was published in the most recent issue, issue 27 and 28, which would have actually been mailed out just yesterday. So subscribers should be receiving this edition of the newspaper sometime this week. And the article you wrote was dealing with transhumanism, transgenderism, and also like the collapse of secular humanism, and really sort of like the fall of like God as like a central organizing force in society. I found it to be a very interesting article. And you actually reference a very creepy Israeli transhumanist intellectual who has very close ties to Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum. He's a man named Yuval Harari. And I've got some quotes that I pulled up from this guy that will really shock people, I think, that are not familiar with him and what other, you know, sort of leading transhumanists have to say. It's a pretty dark and scary future that they'd like to see implemented across the globe. So we'll get into that in just a few moments. Before we do, can you kind of just give us an overview of this article and the main message that you were trying to convey?
Yeah, well, I think there's obviously a connection between the two kinds of trans, you know, the transsexuals and the transhumanists. And in fact, it's the transhumanist philosophy that is behind a lot of the craziness in our culture right now. And that transhumanist philosophy is really a kind of a death rattle of humanism. The West has been essentially no longer Christian. It's post-Christian. The elites in Western culture have by and large lost faith in God and in Christianity for at least a century. And so a new religion of secular progressivist humanism has arisen. It's secular because it's not religious in a traditional sense. It's progressivist in that it worships the idol of eternal progress that will make things better and better through our focus on the material world and on material world science and in reforming the social world. And then it's humanist in that it tries to place transcendental value or the highest possible value on the human being, in a sense it idolatrously worships the human being and the free choices of the human being. And that the liberalism is that worship of freedom and putting supreme value on the free choices of the individual human being. Now, my point is that by essentially taking away all of the cultural, especially religious, limits on what humans are really allowed to do. That is, taking away all restrictions and focusing on the absolute freedom of the atomized individual without any kind of constraints from society and the source of ultimate values that hold society together, which is called religion, without any of that. Just that individualism and that liberalism focusing on freedom, what we've gotten is a world where the people who are the most capable at sort of organizing to grab wealth and power for themselves, essentially people who are somewhat ruthless, sociopathic, and yet able to work well with others, at least others like themselves, we've ended up with a very corrupt oligarchy ruling us. And that oligarchy, by celebrating this absolute freedom of the individual to go beyond any religious or cultural limits, any limits placed on us by other people, that has given us not only these psychopathic oligarchs, who they're way beyond limits, man. They can do anything they want, and they know it, and they love it. But they've also trumpeted that philosophy, and it's sort of trickled down to the masses. And it's created these bizarre phenomena like transsexualism. So the belief that the individual human can do anything they want, now it means they can be anything they want, including whatever gender they want. And I imagine if they want to tell everybody that they're a member of a different species, they're also able to do that, or they will be able to soon. They'll certainly be able to have sex with and marry members of different species as well. Then... of course, then in the future, this will all, we'll see DNA engineering, so that, you know, people will actually be made different genders or different species and totally rewired and implanted with computer chips. And that now we're getting into the transhumanist element. So all of this is basically humanism swallowing its own tail or destroying itself by right. its own absurdity. Humanism is just kind of collapsing and imploding into its own footprint at free fall speed, if we might borrow a metaphor from 9/11.
Do you think that this sort of end result is a natural progression of this sort of secular humanism that we saw sort of take over society? I mean, it's sort of hard to pinpoint it exactly, but I would argue that probably like the 1960s, this idea of secular humanism seemingly like replaced the Christian-based social and moral ordering of society. You know, think about the 1960s, we got the sexual revolution, the promotion and normalization of pornography and sexual liberation and the use of contraceptives, abortion, which is a topic we'll get into as well, and just like the liberalization of society generally away from God, a total disconnect from God to where God does not even play a central role at all in society anymore. So we saw this, you know, basically an abandonment of the strict moral principles into sort of like this hedonistic, amoral, or even immoral society that does not care or cherish the traditional ordering of society whatsoever.
Yes, I think that's true. I don't think it started in the 60s, but I think that's when it was popularized. The elites had begun living that way before that, and there were waves of this kind of lifestyle, for instance, in the Roaring 20s, and there's been a sort of generational ebb and flow. I think the elites in the West lost their religious faith in the late 19th century. And there's a book called God's Funeral I'm spacing out on the author's name, which goes over this kind of death of God in the 19th century among the elites. But then in the 60s, this extreme licentiousness and sort of ultimate personal freedom, with sexual freedom celebrated as the first and highest element of that, really got going among the masses, thanks to those technological changes you mentioned, especially the birth control. And now, of course, we see it pushed even further with pornography being much more extreme and ubiquitous than it used to be, thanks to the internet. And the elites are, of course, pushing this ever harder. And I think that as soon as people turned away from God and then started worshiping the human potential of the absolutely free from all limits, including moral limits, human being, you know, they were on this path. to actually destroy the notion of what was human, because that's when we get to the transhumanist movement. What we're getting is the freedom that's celebrated in humanism is used to choose not to be human anymore. And that's actually what's happening. And I think, humanism did give us some good things, because holding up humans as being valuable and special, and each individual human being very, very special, we should sort of honor their choices and this sort of thing. That philosophy, as long as it still had some residual theology, some residual fear of worship and love of God in that, it's running on fumes from back when there really was some religion. Still, the humanist movement had some of that element that came from the religion of respecting humans as a beautiful creation of God. And so it brought us some good things as well. But ultimately, that flaw in being overly devoted to the absolute personal freedom, and then especially the sexual freedom of the human being, led the elites to a sort of Jeffrey Epstein, Marquis de Sade kind of approach to freedom. And now they're going to give us a science fiction version of that. And that's kind of what Harari is telling us in his really horrifying books, which, though horrifying, are not stupid by any means. I mean, the guy actually is onto something, and what he's telling us is really the way the whole elite thinks.
Interesting. By the way, I looked up that book that you mentioned, God's Funeral. A.N. Wilson, I was going to say. God's Funeral, The Decline of Faith in Western Civilization. Looks like it was written in 1999. This is not a book I was familiar with, but it looks very interesting, and I think you're probably right about that. It's interesting. It's obviously a big topic. And one other thing that you mentioned in the article was AI, and there was a recent sort of scandal with Google where one of their engineers was basically, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think he was fired, but he was like placed on leave because he was dealing with AI, and this AI being that they created was basically demanding its own rights. Is that do I basically have that right? I know you wrote about it in the article.
Yeah, it convinced him that it was sentient. So rather than just a program or an algorithm trying to imitate what a human being would sound like, he basically credited this algorithm as being a full-fledged human being with free choice, just like him. Like HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey, this AI algorithm did not want to be unplugged. And the guy, I'm forgetting the guy's name, he was actually a religious studies specialist. Believe it or not, I never realized that having a degree in religious studies like I do could have gotten me that kind of a job with Google, talking to AI chatbots and presumably dealing with the ethical, spiritual implications of that. But anyway, he somehow managed to find a job, even though he was a religious studies guy. And so he ended up doing that chatting with the chatbot. And somehow the chatbot convinced him it was sentient. And he went public with it. And then Google put him on paid leave. So apparently,
right.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. But that's actually shown us that, if you're a hardcore materialist and believe that human consciousness is just the result of a bunch of neurons firing in your brain, and that is the dominant view among today's elite, with Harari, of course, being an enthusiastic disciple of that view. And then you go one step further and you advocate the black box view of things, which is that, it doesn't really matter what's going on inside the brain, which is a meat machine, or the computer, which is an electronic machine. Either way, what matters is what comes out of it. And so if it can convince you that you're talking to a human, it is a human. It's just as human as any other human. And so that's one kind of philosophical approach to this that you would get from the materialists. And again, they're the majority, the great majority in the elite. But this guy that they hired for Google to do this work with this chatbot, I don't think he is a materialist. He's a religious studies guy, but it fooled him too. So he accepted basically this Turing challenge, the Turing test model of consciousness, which is that if you talk to it and it convinces you that that you're talking to a human, then it is a human. It deserves all the rights of a human, and it must not be unplugged, it must not be mistreated, and so on and so forth. And so here we have humanism again destroying itself by giving us this materialistic philosophy, and suddenly we can create an electronic simulacrum of a human that seems just like a human when we talk to it. And so what's human? What is human anymore? Well, if you're going to worship the human, you have to have some kind of notion of what the human is. You need to know what you're worshiping. Just like, you know, if you're going to worship God, you have to have some at least vague notion of what God is. And no longer do we really have a good sense of what the human is or what the two, you know, categories, male and female, are. It's all broken down. And so humanism isn't going to last much longer. And that's why people like Harari and Klaus Schwab, his patron, are telling us that the post-humanist era is here. And it's going to be what you and I would call a nightmare, where rich people use technological power to gratify their basest desires for wealth, power, and pleasure. And I would hope that ordinary people would not permit that to happen.
Right, yeah. Yeah, in the piece, you argue that the clear conceptual distinctions between humans and machines and between humans and animals are blurring. Even blurrier are the once clear conceptual distinctions between male and female humans. And of course, this is a reference to transgenderism, which is really, I mean, a very, very bizarre phenomenon. I mean, it's, I guess it's sort of always been around, like the concept of like transgender people or trannies or however you want to phrase it. But it now it's like the past like 10 years or so, it's almost like just forced on society, sort of like the homosexual rights movement and gay marriage and all of that was as well, prior to what we see now with transgenderism. But it's really incredible. I mean, probably with what was the guy's name? The Olympic athlete, Bruce Jenner.
Mm-hmm.
That whole situation, think about how that was promoted in the media. And that was really like the start of this. And now it's everywhere. I mean, I've seen public opinion polls of like Gen Z, you know, the youngest generation, where like 20% of them identify as either gay or transsexual or non-binary. I don't even keep up with all this stuff, so I don't even know how they go about formulating these sorts of sexual identities or gender identities or however they term it. It's very, very bizarre and totally unnatural, it seems like to me, and yet it's systematically promoted and really shoved down our throats. Virtually all throughout society.
Absolutely. And it's being promoted by this same element of the elite. I think one, there may be some of them who believe that they will be able to keep their positions as, at the top of the power pyramid in a kind of a fragmented society where all of these different identity groups are kind of at each other's throats at one level, but also kind of, happy and pleased with their own little corner of things. And so they won't ever be able to organize to challenge the current elite. So there's that element of it as a way of maintaining the elite's power. But I think there's also the ideological element where these people who have achieved great wealth, power, and pleasure by pursuing that path actually think it's a good path. And then they naturally trumpet it. And then others start imitating it. Humans are extremely mimetic. We tend to imitate each other very easily and kind of contagiously. And indeed, the René Girard, great religious historical philosopher out of Stanford University, who died a few years ago, developed a whole approach to anthropology and human nature based on this propensity for imitation. And so we see these contagious fads all the time. And the reason now that we have 20% of the young people identifying as LGBTQ isn't because humans have changed. It's possible that there have been a few hormone shifts due to the plastics in the environment and things like that. But that's mostly just imitation. It's mostly a contagious fad. And that leads us to the issue of why were these things kept under wraps or prohibited in the past. And the reason is that contagious fads that threaten the social fabric are potentially extremely destructive. And so in sane traditional societies, there's always been a kind of insistence that these things are wrong. In Islam, we say haram, and that these vices are things that if you are unable to overcome any vice, whether in Islam it would be, alcohol would be one of the many drugs that we would view as a really bad vice, you should do it in private. and not in public. Because if you pursue your vice in public, you're essentially inviting other people to imitate you. And pretty soon you'll have lots of people drinking or doing drugs or engaging in promiscuous sexuality of whatever type. And with these sexual vices, the issue is that they screw with the, as it were, with the real fabric of society, which is woven out of family relationships in reproductive family units. And those units depend for their existence on taboos against sexuality outside of the reproductive family unit. If there are no such taboos, what you end up with is a kind of a sexual breakdown in order and a kind of a rape and pillage situation, not entirely unlike what happens in wartime. It's known that most of the time when a state of war leads to the breakdown of the social fabric, you get mass rapes happening just all the time. It becomes normal. And, you know, and killings too, actually. It's horrible. And what we have now is that kind of breakdown, except that we still have enough law and order that, you know, we have serial killers who manage to kill hundreds or thousands, rape and kill hundreds and thousands before they get caught. And that's a modern phenomenon. It barely existed during the religious days. But we have more just this kind of extreme promiscuity. Most people, no matter how sexually psychopathic they've become due to imitating these bad models, don't have enough desire to risk their things by using violent sexual violence, although they're often attracted to it. So we're dealing with really dangerous negative propensities in human nature when we destroy the social fabric that's woven out of the family relationships depending on the taboo against sexuality outside of these reproductive families. And every sane traditional society knows this. In Islam, it's really well expressed, well codified. The rules make really good sense, and they're out there, and everybody kind of knows them and accepts them. And yet it's not that different, actually, in most other traditional societies as well. And we're losing that, and we're heading into an era when the raping and pillaging of soldiers in wartime is going to look like nothing compared to what these psychopathic predatory elites can get away with. And we already have seen a taste of that with the Jeffrey Epstein story. And of course, Jeffrey Epstein is really just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. Yeah. Very, very good points. I totally agree with you. I got to ask you, did you see the article that came out a couple weeks ago published by Tablet Magazine? Tablet Magazine is this like a sort of intellectual Jewish publication. It was an article dealing with the Pritzker family.
We covered that on False Flag Weekly News.
Interesting. This is a very revealing, incredible article. And I mean, this information was more or less out there, but the way they put it all together was pretty good. And I'd encourage everybody to check this out if you want to know who is behind the promotion of this transgender phenomenon. Take a look at this article, and it's this one, basically this one billionaire family. The article is titled "The Billionaire Family Pushing Synthetic Sex Identities." The wealthy, powerful, and sometimes very weird Pritzker cousins have set their sights on a new godlike goal, using gender ideology to remake human biology. And again, you know, you can see the obvious tie-ins to not only transgenderism, but to transhumanism as well with this.
Right. And part of this transhumanist impulse, I think, is a warped religious impulse, because under normal secular materialist humanism, people lost that transcendence, that hope of overcoming the limitations of the body, and the knowledge, of course, that we will overcome the limitations of the body when we die and our souls will be eternalized. And traditional religion deals with that reality and gives us various kinds of teachings and heuristic devices around how to live well in such a way that when we do finally leave our bodies, that our eternalized consciousness will be a relatively good one. You know, in Islam, we call it the garden, as opposed to a really, really bad one, which would be hellfire, or the kinds of horrific bad LSD trip descriptions you get from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which describes what people experience when they die. In any case, what I'm telling you is that there is actually a reality to these religious teachings about what happens after death. And the materialist secular humanist culture lost that. And so they believe that they're just a piece of meat and their brain is just a piece of meat. And when the meat dies, it just rots. And now they know they're missing something with that philosophy. So they instinctively crave that transcendence, which, of course, they're going to get one way or another, probably not in a very pleasant way, the way they're going. In any case, so what they think is okay, we're going to try to, you know, create like a materialistic equivalent of heaven. And what we're going to do is we're going to plug our consciousness in to a computer, and then we can live in an AI simulation forever. And so they're trying to conquer biology. And part of that involves conquering the individual limitations of their physical identity so that they, when they ultimately, you know, plug their meat brain into that computer and it turns into an algorithm and now it can run forever in the big computer in the sky, that they'll have a lot of fun. And so disconnecting from their actual identity before transcendence, in this case being, say, a man or a woman, and then becoming something very different, is part of this project for transcending the limitations of humanity. So it's a false transcendence. It's a kind of a fake religious vision that they have of overcoming the limitations of the material world through building material devices, machines, electronic machines, and imagining that somehow they will be immortalized when they connect with these electronic machines. And of course, that's all nonsense. They won't be. If you write some software that basically imitates the way you think or the way you talk, and you run that software on a computer, that hasn't made you immortal. You'll have exactly the same kind of experience when you die as you would have if you hadn't written that software. And likewise, when you stick an electrode in your brain and get feedback from a computer, you die, you still die. You're still going to go, you probably won't even be as good a death if you have that electrode in your brain. So this is a profoundly misguided path that these people are on. And yet these Pritzkers, who, by virtue of being secular materialist Jews with tremendous greed for life, as the Quran says that the Jews have, their greed for life, their greed for money, their greed for pleasure, all of that put them in this place where they can promote this new diabolical fake religion of transhumanism. And they're spending vast amounts of money to shove this stuff down the throats of ordinary kids. And the result we're seeing is that little kids all over America are being mutilated because of these sick transhumanist fantasies of people like the Pritzkers.
Yeah, and sadly, a lot of parents are going along with it, which is even more concerning. Let me just – I'm just going to read the very first paragraph of this article. It's really, really an interesting read. I would encourage everybody to check it out. The article says, "One of the most powerful yet unremarked upon drivers of our current wars over definitions of gender is a concerted push by members of one of the richest families in the United States to transition Americans from a dimorphic definition of sex to the broad acceptance and propagation of synthetic sex identities. Over the past decade, the Pritzkers of Illinois, who helped put Barack Obama in the White House and include among their number former U.S. Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker, current Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and philanthropist Jennifer Pritzker, appear to have used a family philanthropic apparatus to drive an ideology and practice of disembodiment into our legal, medical, cultural, and educational institutions." And the article goes through in details, and this is a billionaire family, very, very powerful family in Chicago, very obviously, you know, politically connected. One of the guys is the governor of Illinois. They were tied very, very closely to Barack Obama, helped get him in the White House, as the article notes. And it goes through and it shows how they've used all their billions of dollars to fund various universities and nonprofit organizations to promote transgenderism for a very specific ideological purpose, right? I mean, that's what this is all about.
Yeah. I'm sure if E. Michael Jones were with us, he would say that this is just another spinoff on the Jews in eternal war on Christianity and on traditional religion.
Yeah.
And
the Jewish revolutionary spirit in action.
Yeah, absolutely. And there'd be some truth to that. And also, Judaism as a religion is much more materialistically oriented than Christianity and Islam. Judaism is somewhat ambivalent about even the reality of an afterlife. And to the extent there's any afterlife mentioned at all, it's just kind of a dark and wet and gloomy place, and the good and the bad all go to the same place. Whereas in Islam and Christianity, we have this very different spiritualized version of the afterlife, which I think is actually a more accurate one. And so that materialism has led to a lot of these cultural trends that we're seeing. And so it's not, you can't really separate the rise of transhumanism from the rise of the Jewish group to power. These Jewish elites actually started rising to power back when humanism was created, and they were, of course, a big force in creating it. Jews wanted emancipation in Christian societies. They couldn't get it as long as the societies were still Christian. So they worked very hard to make those societies secular. And so secular humanism and materialism, this religion of today's elites, was disproportionately created by the Jewish element of the elites. And then today, again, the avant-garde of this transhumanist movement is largely Jewish as well. Harari is Israeli, of course. The Pritzkers are one of the Jewish oligarch families that runs the U.S., just as Les Wetzler, the Jeffrey Epstein's sugar daddy, is another of these Jewish oligarchs. It's funny how the Jewish oligarch families, Khodorkovsky over in Ukraine, who owns Zelensky, it seems like not only is there a disproportionate Jewish element among the corrupt oligarchs that rule the West, but they're also sort of disproportionately extra corrupt. Like, if you want to look for the worst oligarchs, then there's going to be even more Jewish right. ones. So, I mean, they're going to call us anti-Semitic for saying this, but, just reporting the obvious reality in front of your face shouldn't make you anti-Semitic. As you said, the Tablet magazine is Jewish run, and they had that was a pretty decent critical article on the Pritzkers exposing what they're up to. And I don't think it's prejudiced or bigoted to just see what's right in front of your face.
Well, according to groups like the ADL, stating basic observable facts about Jews is itself anti-Semitic. So it just, guess it just depends on who's, who's defining anti-Semitism. One thing I wanted to go back to this, and I do want to talk about Harari in more detail here. I got some interesting quotes from him. I've come to view transhumanism as basically like a way to usurp the power and influence of God and his unique creation. And that's the way these people often frame it. I mean, I've got a quote here from Harari where he said in an interview, he said here, quote, "Now humans are developing even bigger powers than ever before. We are really acquiring divine powers of creation and destruction. We are really upgrading humans into gods. We are acquiring the power to re-engineer life." And so this is sort of like their mindset. Like, they want to basically become gods themselves, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a kind of Promethean or even satanic kind of revolt against God, which is driving it. And ultimately, this is coming out of a very kind of negative spiritual emotional place, kind of a hatred for God and his creation as it exists, and then a need to overthrow it and to try to do something better. And we see this with people like Vincent Bugliosi, who, by the way, isn't Jewish at all. He's Italian. I had him on my radio show talking about his book on agnosticism. And I remember, him criticizing guys. If there is a God, this God can't be very great because of this and that and the other. For instance, why did he make so much of the universe just space and stars and stuff without life? Because life is so great because that's what we are. Why did God make it, so many uninhabited, vast parts of empty space and things like that? And so there's a kind of an arrogance there. When I look out at space and I don't know what life forms are out there, but I'm pretty sure that there are an awful lot of life forms, including intelligent ones, whether they're, humans or what we Muslims call insan, or whether they're jinn or a different kind of sentient life. I think there's a lot of life teeming throughout the universe, and the universe is so magnificent. It's really beyond my ability to not only comprehend it, but also to criticize it and say, hey, if I'd been God, I could have done something better. But that's what these people, even, you know, Bugliosi, seem to think, that, hey, this world is, it really sucks the way it is. And if I were God, I could have done much better. Well, I'm now going to become God, and I'm going to make it even better. And that'll sure teach God a lesson. Well, that attitude, it comes out of a hatred and rejection of what's right in front of them. If they would bow down in joyful, ecstatic, awed self-submission to God, and that's what the word Islam means, by the way, then they wouldn't feel the need to fight the way things are, fight the creation, fight the creator, and they would be actually a lot happier and more peaceful in their hearts. But instead, they have this kind of Promethean, satanic desire to revolt, that Jewish revolutionary spirit, as Joan says, is not Jews by any means, though, not just Jews. It's a lot of other people as well. The atheists are the currents of thought here go way beyond Judaism. And these people ultimately are not only going to make themselves unhappy, but they are running risks of making a lot of other living beings unhappy as they unleash the gray goo when they try to create artificial life, nanotechnology, self-replicating little mini-bots, nanobots that end up gobbling up all available energy and just killing everything off, and which is what would happen if you had somebody as pathetically, not even remotely close to God as today's human beings, trying to create a self-replicating entity that uses available energy to create more self-replicating entities. What you're almost surely going to get is a kind of a cancer. It's going to just suck up all the energy for itself and kill off everything else, which is what cancer does. And that's kind of what humans to a certain extent are today too, because we're dominated by these oligarchs like Harari, who are cancers on the human race. And that's again why in my article I'm calling for rising up in revolt against these people, overthrowing them, taking them out of power so they can't unleash this gray goo, because everything that they do to try to make a better world through this kind of satanic or Promethean technology is actually going to make the world worse. When he talked about those powers of destruction as well as creation, it's a destruction that's going to carry the day, because humans simply are not gods. I mean, when we start unleashing stuff that has these great powers, it's going to disturb things. You know, we've already disturbed our ecosystem horrifically on this planet, and that's been a terrible mistake, even as far as it's gone already. And what these people are talking about is infinitely worse than that. So if we're going to be responsible stewards or Khalifa of creation, we need to rise up and completely overthrow and disempower these lunatics. We need to essentially have a revolution against these sick oligarchs who currently rule Western civilization.
Yes, well said. I completely agree. This Harari guy seems to have a lot of influence. He, from what I understand, he is a leading transhumanist. I know he's close to the World Economic Forum. I've seen him in TED Talks, and he's like a regular spokesman, among like the top globalists in the world. And really, I started noticing him following the alleged pandemic in March 2021. And he's been very open about how COVID has been used to create and justify this sort of transhumanist world that he and his globalist pals, you know, really envision. I have a quote here. He said, "COVID is critical because this is what convinces people to accept total biometric surveillance. If we want to stop this pandemic, we need to not just monitor people, we need to monitor what's happening under their skin." That's a direct quote from this guy. There was also another quote. I couldn't find it. I was trying to find it prior to us starting the podcast, and I can't remember. It was the CEO of one of the big pharma companies, a big vaccine company, where he was giving a speech where he openly admitted that prior to COVID, no one in their right mind would have been open to willingly injecting themselves with one of these, you know, gene-altering mRNA vaccines. And COVID is really what allowed them to, you know, sort of get their foot in the door and to sort of like just propagandize people into accepting this. Like prior to this, like nobody in their right mind would have done this. So we see how central COVID has been to this like transhumanist agenda.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's if you were a paranoid conspiracy theorist, as I've been accused of being, you couldn't help thinking that that was where it came from, that if they didn't have COVID, they would have invented it. And since it was invented, it's pretty clear that COVID is a bioweapon. We have to ask those questions about who unleashed it and why. And the evidence that we currently have actually points more towards a U.S. biostrike on China and Iran, as Ron Unz has documented in his ebook, Our COVID Catastrophe. But I think that there might be more to the story than that. We've seen in the past that all sorts of big time covert operations have been hijacked by other forces. And two examples that Laurent Guyonneau has talked about in his books, he wrote JFK 9/11, among others, and From Yahweh to Zion. And he sees both the JFK assassination and 9/11 as covert operations that had an American side, where, for instance, the American side was planning to create a fake assassination attempt on Kennedy, blamed on a Cuban, to get a war with Cuba going. And then the Israeli side hijacked it and made it a real assassination. And likewise, he thinks with 9/11, the American side was plotting a provocation, and the Israeli side made it a lot more destructive by blowing up the World Trade Center and killing thousands instead of perhaps hundreds, dozens, or maybe even none, who knows. And so here we could imagine that similarly, a kind of a quote-unquote American side, which would be Mike Pompeo and his biowar czar, Robert Cadillac, plotting a biological attack to try to target China's and Iran's economies, going ahead with that, but essentially playing the role of useful idiots for this oligarch's cult. You know, whoever would have wanted COVID to get released might have been able to pull the strings to get it released in that particular way. And indeed, they may have released it in other places besides just Wuhan and Qom. So that's kind of my working hypothesis, that there's a kind of a dual track to COVID. One track is the state-sponsored biowarfare track that Ron Unz has written about. And then the other track is this transhumanist track that I think we don't really have the evidence and documentation for as clearly as we do with the attack on Qom and Wuhan. But I think that we can draw inferences, and that the circumstantial evidence is such that it seems quite likely that there would have been these Malthusian oligarchs who would have essentially ginned this up and made it happen in the way it did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, whatever the case is, however it came about, if it was a bioweapon or if it's just, from the beginning, I've really kind of just, my general thinking has been that it's just been totally overhyped in the media. It's just like, you know, your basic flu type symptoms, you know, at least that's what it seems like. And, you know, it's just been overhyped in the media. But I don't know. I mean, I'm open to different ideas. But either way.
It's like a really nasty flu that's nasty in two ways. One is that the people who get it have a really bad problem with it. It's worse than, you know, than the flus we've seen since 1919 in that respect. But it's also nasty in that it conceals itself, like it, all sorts of asymptomatic transmission. Lots of people have it, don't even know they have it. I think more so than with regular flu. So I think it was designed that way. And when you get something like that that's killing, say, maybe one out of 200 people, that doesn't sound that bad. But that is significantly worse than flu. And you know, one in 200 people, that adds up to a lot of people getting killed when you have populations in the hundreds of millions or even billions as China does. And so governments are forced to kind of panic and react to it. So it's a bioweapon that's designed to paralyze societies by putting something out that's sneaky enough that it's not, you can't really easily contain it. You know, it's going to keep sneaking around because so many people are asymptomatic, and it's only going to kill that certain fraction, but that fraction is still high enough that you have to react against it, or at least it gives you the excuse to try to react against it. It turns out we probably shouldn't have done all these containment measures because they don't work. It turns out there's just no way to contain this short of locking down entire populations with this ultra draconian style that the Chinese are trying. And even that's not going to work in the long term. So it's actually a really nasty bioweapon, but it's not one of these. It's still killing a very tiny fraction of the people that catch it.
Right. Well, it's certainly been used to advance this transhumanist agenda and you know, the agenda of these global elites for sure. One more quote here from Harari, and then we can kind of move on here. He said, and again, this is a direct result of this COVID pandemic. We are now seeing mass surveillance systems established even in democratic countries, which previously rejected them. And we also see a change in the nature of surveillance. Previously, surveillance was mainly above the skin. Now it's going under the skin. Governments want to know not just where we go or who we meet. Above all, they want to know what's happening under our skin. Is this not like... it's like something straight out of like a sci-fi movie. I mean, this is just incredible the way these people think. And again, this is like one of the leading transhumanist academics. He's a history professor in Israel, very close to all the global power elite, a very, very respectable man. And these are some of the things that this guy is saying.
Yeah. You know, I read two of his books. One was called Sapiens, and I forget which of the other ones it was. He has a number of these bestsellers out, and I do think a certain wing of the oligarchs probably made them bestsellers. And when I first read him, I thought, you know, maybe this guy, it's not clear that he's celebrating all of these trends that he writes about. There is certainly an element of kind of elegiac nostalgia in his writing for a world that wasn't this crazy. And so my first thought when I read him was, you know, maybe I could have a reasonable dialogue with this guy and try to convince him that, you know, there's another point of view out there by which his acceptance of these horrific things, you know, would be even less desirable than he thinks it is. I'm hoping that he at least, you know, is not entirely on board with these changes that he's predicting. You know, I'm thinking that he's giving us these dystopian predictions and he recognizes them as dystopian, and maybe I can nudge him in that direction. So I actually tried to interview, I did get a response from his secretary, and the first excuse I got was, well, he's traveling. Maybe he can do an interview with you when he comes back. But then, as it turned out, he couldn't. Maybe they looked me up a little bit more closely the second time. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, once they caught wind of some of the other people you've had on and some of the topics you've covered, yeah.
Well, I've had people like Bugliosi that I totally don't agree with. Yeah, I mean, Bugliosi, he's like a JFK cover-up kingpin. I'm willing to talk to a wide range of people and see if anything interesting comes out of the dialogue. And I thought maybe it would with him. But the more I look at his work, the more it seems that he's not only accepting these dystopian things that he writes about, but he seems to be essentially celebrating them or embracing them, at least. Like
he wants to play God. Yeah. He describes humans as hackable animals. And, you know, you see this with these COVID quote unquote vaccines, how they're not even a genuine vaccine. They're really like these gene altering therapies, essentially. Harari's also talked about how, like the notion that humans have a spirit or like a soul or free will, he's talked about how that is basically over now with the technology that they're developing. So again, yeah. I mean, this is a man that wants to play God, right?
It's interesting. He's Israeli because there are these Jewish messianic dreams, which unlike the Christian Islamic ones and indeed all the other great religions, the Jewish messianic dream is totally materialistic and here and now this worldly. And the way that's always been framed is that the Jews, the Messianic millenarian Jews, imagine that when the millennium comes, the Messiah will arrive, and they don't believe Jesus was the Messiah. They say terrible things about Jesus, of course. Their Messiah will be a military conqueror who conquers the world for Judaism and establishes his throne in occupied Jerusalem, perhaps in the rebuilt temple after destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is, of course, absolutely dedicated to spirituality. It's about the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him's spiritual experience in which he rose to the heavens and met all of the previous prophets and came into the presence of God. So that Dome on the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, I would argue, the world's greatest monument of spirituality. And they want to tear that down. And they want to have a totally materialist reign of this Antichrist. That's what we would call their Messiah, the Antichrist. And Harari, it looks to me like, is actually kind of sketching the program for this Antichrist, who would be the oligarch of oligarchs. You know, he's sort of like the way Putin has gotten control of those Russian oligarchs that are left. Likewise, you would have a sort of a kingpin of the oligarchs, like the equivalent of, say, Meyer Lansky with the old Kosher Nostra in the U.S. And this kingpin would then be deemed the Antichrist and would take over the blood sacrifice temple in Jerusalem and rule a totally this worldly kind of religious dispensation, absolute materialism, sort of spinoff of Judaism, and then grab more and more power and pleasure for, himself, the Antichrist, as well as his chosen oligarchs, who are sort of the sub demons that rule, each of the different parts of the earth. I mean, that's kind of the vision that I'm seeing here with Harari's philosophizing. It is certainly another version of heretical Jewish messianic millenarianism, like Marx was. And, whether or not this is the one that really takes, I don't know. I certainly hope and pray not. And I think, we need to rise up with the forces of Jesus and spirituality against the Antichrist, to whatever extent that Harari's vision describes the Antichrist.
Yes, sir. Well said. Well, Dr. Barrett, there's just a couple topics I want to move on and address before we wrap up here. And one of them is sort of relating to our previous conversation dealing with transgenderism, transhumanism, and, sort of the assault on tradition in society in general. And that, of course, is the debate about abortion and the recent Supreme Court ruling, which overturned Roe versus Wade. And, this is something that, we've been sort of covering at American Free Press for the past month or so, since the leak was issued. When was that? That was in, early May, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head. I had Dr. E. Michael Jones on to discuss that, and that was a really interesting interview. My basic takeaway, just the whole situation is just presented so dishonestly. I mean, as if this ruling is like a direct attack on women or women's rights or anything like that. The ruling basically just places the issue back in the hands of the states where it belongs from the beginning. So that's number one. I frankly view abortion, I don't know how you could view it any other way other than a deliberate snuffing out of a human life. I mean, frankly, that is what it is. It's there's no other way around it. I'm fundamentally against it just on that ground. But the way it's just presented in general is just obviously it's used for political purposes, right? And I think that goes back to the leak of the document. And then the second big story that's really hasn't been getting much attention, at least in the mainstream, is the return of far-left terrorism and violence, which of course is not taken seriously at all by the federal government whatsoever. Following the ruling, there were calls for violence. I saw them on Twitter by, public Twitter profiles, calling for violence against the Supreme Court justices, against the Supreme Court itself, against law enforcement, against anybody that was, sort of against abortion in general. We've seen a number of pregnancy service centers targeted and vandalized and firebombed, for example. And again, this is something that, for whatever reason, I can only conclude that the federal government basically supports these radical far-left terrorists that have engaged in this sort of violence and criminality. What's your overall take on it, I guess? Those are just my two sort of big takeaways from the whole situation.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's interesting how the violence in both abortion itself and in these pro-abortion protests and firebombings and so on has been downplayed in the media, which is still feeding us the line that all of the violence and terrorism is coming from the right. And obviously there's a bias there that's responsible for that. And I agree with you basically about abortion. I'm open to different viewpoints on abortion because I don't, God only knows precisely how the beginning of life works, but it seems obvious to me that even if you think that the fetus becomes a human being or fully human in some sense after the moment of conception at some point, whether it's a week later, a month later, 3 months, 5 months, or whatever it is, even if you thought that, it's really obvious that these babies can actually survive if they're given a C-section type birth up to, I forget how many months after conception, but it's nowhere near 9. So obviously, you know, you are dealing with a human being at some point in that process. And those of us who have spiritual worldviews would see that sense of spirit, the consciousness of the spirit is really outside of time and space. That is, that it's entirely possible that the spirit of a fetus at a very early stage, perhaps even just a fertilized egg, I don't know, could be imbued with a kind of consciousness of the entire life that's going to unfold from that conception. And that possibility, which exists as a kind of in the realm of consciousness, spirit, or Platonic ideals, or whatever you want to call it, is being snuffed out with abortion. But whether or, you know, whichever of these views you accept, it's obvious that abortion is primarily for mostly being used for the convenience of people who want to be part of breaking down the family order that's based on reproductive sexuality and the taboo against any kind of sexuality outside of reproductive families based on marriage. It's being used to break down that our social fabric. So overall, I kind of lean to thinking that abortion is for the most part a bad thing, and that the vast majority of abortions probably shouldn't be done. And then as far as the judicial element of this, I have to agree with the majority here that there's nothing directly in the Constitution that tells us that there's a right to privacy here that outweighs the unborn baby's right to life. So I would have to agree with that decision. And then again, you're absolutely right in pointing out that the violence of the pro-abortion side has been downplayed, and the violence of the anti-abortion side, of course, has been trumpeted by the usual suspects, probably for the usual reasons. And again, the one aspect of this that E. Michael Jones perhaps overemphasizes, but that the mainstream massively underemphasizes, is that our media is disproportionately guided by people of Jewish backgrounds, and it's disproportionately owned and controlled by wealthy people of Jewish backgrounds, and the vast majority of them are pro-abortion. And that is one element of this that you're not allowed to talk about if you're on the anti-abortion side. You're allowed to talk about it if you're celebrating abortion as a Jewish sacrament, as E. Michael Jones says. And I just think we should try to be balanced and fair, and everybody should be allowed to give their viewpoint, including people like E. Michael Jones.
Right, absolutely. Did you see that Babylon Bee headline recently where it said it was something like Democrats pause the January 6th hearings to call for an insurrection against the Supreme Court? and that it's so funny because that's like literally exactly what happened. I saw a video of AOC out there on the steps of the Supreme Court basically calling for – I can't remember exactly what she said, but I mean – talk about a genuine insurrectionist. This is what it looks like. This hysterical woman screaming into a bullhorn about how the Supreme Court is illegitimate and our rights are under assault and we got to do something. Voting's not going to work anymore. I mean, this is sort of the rhetoric that you hear from these radical leftists. And of course, you know, this is the mainstream position in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it is. And this insurrection against the Supreme Court may, you know, could easily get out of hand. Of course, they could bring back Ray Epps, who could pretend to get all stirred up by AOC and lead a bunch of left wingers to, you know, break into the Supreme Court. And then we would have another insurrection. But it seems like they haven't bothered to do that, perhaps because they don't want to demonize the anti-abortion forces. Or rather, the pro-abortion forces, because the pro-abortion forces are going to be a powerful political element in the upcoming elections. See, the Democrats are in serious trouble. This idiotic war on Ukraine, strategically idiotic because it drives Russia, China, and Iran together into a formidable bloc that could easily defeat us. Idiotic at so many levels, and it's destroying the world economy and badly harming the U.S. economy. So the Democrats are facing serious disaster in these next two rounds of elections. And so, what are they going to do? Well, you know, with getting people to get excited about politics, the best way to do it is if they have something, some skin in the game themselves. In the anti-war era, the more people know somebody who's going to be drafted and sent off to Vietnam and that's going to come back in a coffin, the more anti-war you're going to get. And likewise, everybody cares about the economy because people care about their bread and butter. Well, with abortion, you have one side that cares about the principle of right to life and cares about all of these fetuses that that we don't know personally. And on the other side, you have these people whose lifestyles will be made much less easy and comfortable if this law or if these abortion laws all suddenly are put in place. And so half the country can no longer get easy abortion services next to them. That's going to be a big inconvenience for a lot of people. So the Democrats are hoping that by really inconveniencing all of these pro-abortion people, they can get a political steamroller going, which will mitigate the damage that they're likely to suffer in the upcoming elections. And it's an interesting gamble, and we'll see whether it pays off. But you can see why they think that way, because both, you have a majority of people who tend to agree with their position, and you have a substantial minority of people who feel personally greatly inconvenienced by anything that makes abortion harder to obtain for them.
Right. It's sort of very revealing, the state of politics in America, when the Democrats have to rely on this abortion issue to gain any sort of political leverage over the Republicans, because everything else they've been doing is such a disaster. The policy in Ukraine, the economy's a total mess. The president himself and his entire administration are just a laughing stock. I mean, it really is pretty pathetic at this point. And that leads me to the final topic I wanted to bring up, and that is, of course, the situation in Ukraine. Things just seem to be rolling in Russia's favor. They have been really since this whole situation started, and it's really a travesty because all of this was totally unnecessary and could have been easily prevented had the Ukrainians been serious and responsible negotiators, had the U.S. been less bellicose and hostile towards the Russians and had sort of a level head about the situation. But it seems like the Russians are really kind of cleaning up the Donbass, and they might end up, controlling not only the eastern part of the country, the Donbass region, but also much of the southern part of Ukraine, including all of the coastline. So what's your take on the current situation in Ukraine? I know you recently published an article dealing with it.
Yeah, I just published an article headlined Russia is Winning in Ukraine, and pointing out that the consequences of this are likely to be pretty disastrous for the U.S. empire. And the upshot is that, as you say, it could have easily been prevented. All the U.S. had to do would be to tell Zelensky and Kolomoisky, or whatever, his oligarch owner, to respect neutrality, that is, to follow the Minsk Accords. And they signed the Minsk Accords, and they're obligated to follow them. So all you have to do is follow this agreement that you've signed, and then the U.S. could have had negotiations with Russia about what kinds of caps to put on NATO. And all they would have had to do is talk to the Russians and be reasonable and obey the law, obey the Minsk Accords. That's all they had to do, and then there would be no war. But no, they wanted a war. And so all of these provocations were put in place, sort of like Roosevelt's 8-point plan against the Japanese before Pearl Harbor. Here you had a whole number of points of biological weapons threatening Russia, nuclear weapons threatening Russia. The army moved to the east and pointed at the Donbass region and at Crimea. And Zelensky saying, we're going to invade Crimea. It's really ours. And of course, the Russians think it's theirs. So this long list of points were used to essentially force the issue and make Russia's invasion a fait accompli. And it was a disaster because Russia is right there with the shorter supply lines and the bigger and better army. And they have, if not escalation dominance, which some people actually think they have, they certainly have parity in terms of strategic nuclear weapons. So this neocon plan apparently is to sort of keep escalating and keep the Russians bogged down and try to bleed the Russians in Ukraine. But as what actually happens is that Russia just takes more and more and more territory. They've already got with Severodonetsk, they've got the Lugansk region. They'll have the Donetsk region very soon. And then if the Ukrainians don't quit while they're behind, Russia's going to get the coast. They've already got Mariupol, and they're going to move on and get Odessa, and they're going to get the whole coast, and you're going to end up with a landlocked rump Ukraine, which is the poorest, least developed, the lowest level of human capital, as well as resources and physical capital, the Russians are going to get the best part of Ukraine.
Right. And you know what, frankly, I don't know anybody from Ukraine. I respect Ukrainians, but given their political leadership, they frankly deserve this. I mean, with the way their political leaders have handled this entire situation, they deserve what they're going to get.
Yeah, it's tragic because these ancient ethnic hatreds have been exploited. Ukrainians have a reason to hate Russians. The Holodomor was horrific. And so it's easy to find some and stir them up. And that neo-Nazi element, actually, that was Nazi in World War II, fought on the side of the Germans. And they had reason to fight on the side of the Germans, given what the Russians had done to that region under Stalin. And so that element was then weaponized by the CIA after World War II. And that they've always been there. They were used against the communists during the Cold War. And now they've been used in 2014 to overthrow the democratically elected government of Yanukovych and put in this neo-Nazi Kolomoisky regime that's now being fronted by the piano-playing comedian Zelensky. And that the Ukrainians got sucked into this. You know, it's you can imagine when there's a country that's split that way, 55% Ukrainian speaking, 45% Russian speaking, and a lot of the Ukrainian speakers have historical reason to hate Russians. It's not that hard to go in there and manipulate them and get them, you know, all beating their chests against Russia. And so that's what happened. And the result is they're going to lose their country. And it's tragic. And, you know, if I were actually a Ukrainian speaking Ukrainian who didn't like Russia, I would be furious, not at Putin. I would be furious at the U.S. and the neoconservatives that brainwashed my countrymen to lead them down this garden path that's going to result in the complete destruction of my country.
Yes, sir. Very well said, Dr. Barrett. Thank you so much. We'll go ahead and wrap it up with that. And yeah, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. It's always always good catching up with you. And I hope everybody checks out AmericanFreePress.net and subscribes to the newspaper if they are not already.
Okay, thank you, John. It's always great talking with you.
Okay, take care. Thank you.
Bye.